Yeah, you got to do that.
All right. Okay, the Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. Welcome. Sorry that we are running a couple of minutes late. The first thing is we are still waiting on the final work on the fiscal for Senate Bill 243, so we are going to move, carry that over till Monday. So that will just automatically appear on the agenda for Monday, correct?
Yes.
Great. So, again, do I have to open it and close it, or that's just good enough?
I think that's good enough.
Okay, great.
If you want, I can call up the Secretary of the Senate's office to be sure.
Why don't we just do this? We're carrying over Senate Bill 243 to Monday.
Okay.
A lot faster than calling. And we are going to open up, I don't believe we have any committee bills for introduction today. Is that correct?
You wouldn't have told me if we did, so.
And if you have them, again, bring them. And so we are going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 397.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 397 directs the Department of Human Services to convene a work group to develop a common comprehensive client confidentiality release form for use by public bodies and relevant community organizations. It sunsets the work group on January 2nd, 2019. It directs the Department of Justice to review state laws and recommend to the Legislative Assembly modifications to facilitate better communication in social services delivery. The measure requires DOJ to develop, maintain, and make available an informational sharing guide detailing laws governing the release of certain information. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. And there is a -1 amendment that was posted to OLIS yesterday.
Great. Thank you very much. And I know we've got some folks on a timeline, so I'd like to bring up Dr. Clyde Seike and my friend Elizabeth Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, Oregon Synod. This bill comes to you courtesy of a task force that was a subject established by Senate Bill 450 in the 2013 session, and that task force was around streamlining delivery of human services. One of the things we know is that despite the best intentions of our state workers, that oftentimes people don't get exactly the services they need, or they do get duplication of services, and to get the services that they need, they often have to give the same information over and over and over again to different divisions of the same agency or different agencies to get all the services they need. Furthermore, we know that there are multiple divisions within given agencies, such as the Department of Human Services, and other agencies and community agencies that get funding, such as, for example, Home Forward in the Portland metro area that gets funding from the Department of Housing and Community Services, that also provides really important safety net services for working Oregonians, and yet can't get the information that they need to do this in an efficient way. We want people who are receiving these safety net services to get exactly the right services with the minimum of work on both the part of them and the state agents, because that improves efficiency and it decreases what recipients tend to call agency time, the time that they just spend sitting around waiting, giving the same information over and over again, instead of doing what we want them to do and they want to do, which is get back to work or get the education they need. This bill, in essence, is very straightforward. It does one thing and one thing only. It has DHS bring together a group that would include members from a range of state agencies and community organizations, such as Home Forward or Community Action, that are our partners, the state's partners, in delivering these crucial safety net services, to develop a uniform release of information form. And that form would look perhaps something like this. It would give the person's name and demographic information. It would include a list of agencies or divisions within agencies or perhaps specific programs that the person completing the form would authorize to receive his or her information. And it would have a time limit. It wouldn't be specific instance to instance, because that would just require the form being completed over and over and over again, but it would be time limit, maybe a period of 6 months or a year, whatever the person thought was right. Furthermore, the work of that form would be informed by the Department of Justice. There are a lot of myths, certainly in the general community, I know this from the medical community, but also within state agencies, about what can legitimately be released under the HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Privacy Act, or FERPA, the Federal Education, can't remember what the R stands for, Privacy Act, or other appropriate statutes that protect people's confidentiality. We want to be sure that those statutes are upheld, that people's confidentiality is protected. And conversely, we want to be sure that people aren't withholding information from other workers that could be very, very useful and it can legally be shared. So we want to protect people's rights, we want to protect their privacy, and we want to facilitate them getting the services that they need. We want to be sure that all agency workers and all community agencies, their workers have the training to do the right thing at the right time, to share information in exactly the right way. We want to be sure that this information is used appropriately. There is no intention that it would be disseminated, for example, to DMV. There's no reason for DMV to have this information, and or any other agency that's not directly providing those kinds of safety net services. So its entire intent is to protect people's privacy while facilitating sharing of appropriate information to give people the services that they need to get back on their feet quickly and get off the services as fast as possible. Happy to take questions now or wait till Director Psyche.
Thank you. Is it okay if we let Director Psyche go
Absolutely.
First and then we'll do questions to both of you?
Whatever you prefer.
Thank you.
So, Chair Gelser, I got choked up about this. Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Psyche, Department of Human Services. And really, when you talk about the sharing of information, especially confidential information, a lot of people think it actually sounds like a pretty simple issue, but actually it's one of the most complex issues we deal with because there are so many different rules governing the sharing of information. Organizations all take the responsibility of guarding confidential information or client information very seriously, as well they should, and we're very supportive about that. But it really, at times, I think, serves as a barrier to us being able to provide services to people in a timely manner. So we feel that the bill and the formation of the work group would serve several purposes. First of all, it would bring a variety of different people to the table and would facilitate a discussion around confidentiality and information sharing. And quite honestly, we have a lot of one-off discussions, but we haven't had a forum where we could bring everybody to the table or a large group to the table to really talk about what the issues are. And so I think it would be a very educational experience for all of us, too. Second, I think it provides a level of standardization that is kind of missing now. If you have 10 different agencies, you have 10 different release of information, and at times agencies require certain things to be in the form, and not everything that an agency may require to be in the form is in all the forms. And what that does is oftentimes when we get a new form, we have to work with our partners at DOJ to determine legal sufficiency, and all that does is really add to the time it takes to really provide the service the client really needs. And so we really view this as an efficiency measure, totally cognizant of the protection that needs to be in place. It's something we take very seriously, but I think there's a lot of room for agencies to work together so that when we share information, it's kind of in the most standardized way possible, and it removes a lot of the time we spend going back and forth between each other. And just one other note I want to add. When the Department of Human Services was split into two separate agencies, Oregon Health Authority and DHS, now we had two agencies with two different kind of governing statutes. This arose early on in the process as one of the issues, how we share information. So we actually put together a work group to come up with a common release of information form that the two agencies use, and it has really cut down a lot on the time we spent going back and forth and increased efficiency and helped us to provide services to clients in a more timely manner. So with that, I'll stop and happy to take any questions.
And if I may, Madam Chair, may I just add one point to add on to what Director Psyche said. I have looked at this form, and it's a great starting place to think about. The challenge is that it's targeted at fairly specific information. There's a little box that says, what specific information do you want released? Be specific, because if you say all information, it's going to delay the process, right? And it's a box about that big. And no offense meant to your team, Mr. Director Psyche, but it's tough. No, those of us with bad handwriting would have a little trouble with it. And so the goal is, on the one hand, not to make it too broad, but also to make it be something you can use over and over again, rather than a specific instance by instance having to do this over and over again.
Yeah.
Their form is useful in a lot of circumstances, but we want one that has more general applicability and can be reused on an ongoing basis for a period of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Senator, this is a very obvious question, but I want it on the record.
Yes, sir.
And the necessity of the emergency clause.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson. I appreciate the question. In this case, it has to do with the ability to get the group moving quickly and to make sure that we move, put into place efficiency measures as quickly as possible. To get the right people on the task force can take a little bit of time, and we don't want to delay that until January 1st of next year, Senator. I appreciate and agree with you about overuse of the emergency clause, but I truly believe that this will be a cost-saving measure. It will improve delivery of human services, and appropriate safety net services, and we need to get moving on it as fast as possible to cut costs, improve government efficiency, and do those kinds of things. So it has no intention of being something that would actually, we wouldn't be able to implement anything even until they came back with their recommendations. So it's simply to get the group working fast so we don't delay the work being done.
Follow up. And thank you very much for the answer, because I knew what the answer was.
It's all good.
And I wanted it on the record.
She didn't surprise you.
That's right. I wanted it on the record that it was a general necessity to get the process going.
Absolutely.
And those people that questioned the fact that why did this bill have an emergency clause, I wanted it on the record that it was a necessity to move this forward quickly so we could get a resolution to it and get the process started.
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, thank you so much for the question and getting that on the record. I really appreciate your support and understanding.
Thank you. Any further questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Vice Chair Olson.
So next up, we've got Mike Schmidt and Judge Nan Waller. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
It's good to see you both today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Gelser, and Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. And so I am here today to talk about Senate Bill 397 and how I think that it might interact with the criminal justice system. So my area of expertise is really an adult criminal justice system in Oregon. And we do a lot of work both around research and analysis of how things affect our criminal justice system, but also in providing technical assistance to local counties as they try to navigate how to, you know, deliver services and get the best outcomes for people that are involved in the system. So when I first saw this bill, I thought it was a great opportunity to have that conversation and to get started on a work group that would start to navigate and answer those questions about how we can share information efficiently. And I'll just give you an example from my prior job. I used to be a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, and I was a drug court deputy district attorney. And that is an area where they are great at sharing information. They fill out multiple ROIs from multiple agencies, and everybody shares. But you see the judicial system, you see the mental health system, you see the court system and the public safety system, and they're all sharing information. And it was my experience in that setting that we could very quickly navigate when somebody was starting to get into trouble, whether it was, you know, with their addiction or however it was. But everyone could share that information rapidly and work to get that person back on track so they didn't find themselves going further into the criminal justice side of things. And it was just a great efficiency. And so that's kind of a microcosm of what I think that this bill can accomplish on a wider level. My only other comment would be I also look at this from the research side of things. And in criminal justice, when you want to know if something works, you're very much limited to, does it reduce recidivism? But if you're not a criminal justice person, I'm asked all the time, well, did they end up getting a job? How's their health? Was their health improved? You know, did they use public health services less than they were using them before? And those are just all kinds of measures that in the criminal justice system we don't have access to do. And it's, you know, I think this gives us an opportunity to explore the ability to think of success in the criminal justice system from a wider perspective.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelzer, Vice Chair Olson. My name is Nan Waller, and I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County. And while I see this bill as of great benefit both to individuals, families, and children, I'm going to focus on the impact on children and families based upon my many years on the juvenile bench. It was a regular occurrence when you can see the impact of a lack of good information sharing between agencies, schools, and community providers on children and youth, especially for children who have significant mental health and behavioral issues and who are involved in multiple child-serving systems. When information about prior assessment and evaluation or treatment is not shared, each system, in trying to meet the needs of a child, will begin at the beginning, and they'll do an assessment. A child can easily end up with multiple evaluations and assessments, which is really very duplicative. It's costly. It sometimes leads to inconsistent treatment plans. And it is very confusing and confounding for families and children who aren't sure quite what to do sometimes as they move from system to system. Sometimes the lack of good information sharing will lead to a child being placed in a placement that is not appropriate to meet their level of need because there's not that assessment from the get-go available, which in turn can lead to a child disrupting, and it can also lead to placement burnout. And we have a placement crisis in this state right now, and so we want neither for the individual child or for our placements not to have a good match of child and placement and a correct level of need. These are children both in the dependency system and the delinquency system who have multiple complex needs and by very virtue of their being children are involved in multiple child caring systems. It was not infrequent when I was on the juvenile bench to have children who had had 5-6 evaluations, but because they had significant need and were rolling from placement to placement, we could never get a handle on their treatment needs, and they'd go to the next system and they'd have another evaluation. And as you see a child move through, we are a one child, one family, one judge court, which means that once you have a child on your docket, they're yours forever. And I would see as my children would sometimes move from child welfare to juvenile justice to OYA, and we wouldn't have them in a stable enough placement because we didn't have the information from the get-go that maybe the system prior had done the evaluation, but it didn't follow the child quickly enough so that we couldn't make use of that evaluation. This concern about information sharing, not timely following children and families, as well as concerns about appropriate placements for children with significant mental health needs and trauma histories, led to the Chief Justice convening the Juvenile Justice Mental Health Task Force in 2014. And Judge Grief from Jackson County and I chaired the task force, which consisted of stakeholders to the juvenile justice system, so a wide variety of people from all parts of the juvenile justice system. And over the course of 16 months, studying the current system, looking at best practices, and surveying all juvenile directors and juvenile judges in Oregon, we made recommendations. And a central recommendation was that we would have better information sharing in Oregon with a guide to help people in the field. Oftentimes information is shared not because people don't recognize that it would lead to better results, but because of fear of not understanding the multiple laws, both at the federal and state level, not having an easy-to-use universal release form. Oftentimes parents are difficult for the agencies that they're working with to get a hold of, and so when you have each agency requiring their own form, we lose time and we lose consistency in terms of that information following through. One of the task force's recommendations is that we provide that legal framework and then the information sharing guide and a universal release of information so that people are both have the guidance that they need, are not afraid of what may happen if they share information that they think maybe they shouldn't be sharing, and that we will have the ability of those that we serve, parents and children and individuals, having an easier time of being able to release the information that they know that they need. Right before getting into the car, I was doing a juvenile hearing, a woman who's been involved in the system for probably 15 years. I've watched as each of her children has entered the system given her long series of addiction issues. And she said, I'm just tired. I've been in a lot of places. And I thought, what we need is the ability to gather all that information together again. So this time we are going to get it. We are going to try again and have a better idea of what you need. Senate Bill 397 is needed to ensure that the recommendations from our task force and the recommendations that I think anybody operating with people involved in multiple systems recognizes that we need. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Other questions for Senator Dimbrough?
I do. Thanks, Madam Chair. Let me say I'm very supportive of this. I think it's great. I think it's long overdue. I think it's really important. In the worlds that you inhabit, do you see other states out there that are doing good jobs with this, you know, where information is shared productively and to a good end?
Thank you, Senator Dimbrough. We looked at both the information sharing guides from Arizona and the state of Washington, both of which are very comprehensive and really gave us faith and hope that it can be done, and it can be done. It'll take some time to get everything in order, but yes, it is being done in other parts of the country.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And next up, we have Stephen Wolf and Jess Daly. Welcome.
Chair Gelzer, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Steve Wolf. I'm the Chief Counsel of the Department of Justice's General Counsel Division, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of the department in support of SB 397. I think the earlier witnesses have all very amply and articulately covered the benefits that this would bring, the inefficiencies in the current system, and the real and potential harms that those inefficiencies can bring to the people who engage with and are served by our human services system in Oregon. And so we think that it's a great thing to try to bring greater transparency, seamlessness among the agencies and entities that work together to serve our people in the state. This bill gives the Department of Justice three discrete roles to play. One is on the work group to help develop the confidentiality release form. The second is to develop over the next 2 years, review and develop a set of legislative proposals to address any sort of inconsistencies or traffic jams that the current statutes create. And the third is to develop the information sharing guide that was just alluded to. And we think these are all the kinds of good of the state and good for the state's people projects that the department really likes to get involved in, and that we only rarely, I think, have the real opportunity to do so. But in all, I think this is a very good proposal, and we support it wholeheartedly. So,
thank you very much. Thank you. My name is Jess Daly. I'm happy to be here. Senator Gelzer and Senator Olson. I am a Master's of Public Policy candidate from the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State. I am specializing in information and data systems policy and anti-poverty tax policy. And I'm here today to talk to you a little bit about my master's thesis and the future of human services. I'm really pleased to see this bill come before the committee. The integration and security of personal data is vital to the progression of human services in the 21st century. As part of my master's thesis, I've been working closely with Beverly Stein at the National Policy Consensus Center in partnership with the Oregon Business Council's Poverty Task Force to conceptualize the future of human services delivery. The result is a concept called the Lifelong Prosperity Accounting System. I'm not going to get too into it, but just to give you a general idea, it is essentially a single access point for human services that also serves as an account for every Oregonian
that's set up at birth that includes sub-accounts that activate and deactivate over the course of a lifetime. Basically, we're trying to design a fully integrated tool to help overcome poverty and help individuals reach their goals of self-sufficiency. The purpose of these accounts is to provide transparency and access to entitlement dollars through a single electronic portal, and also to support financial planning and self-sufficiency by utilizing integration, social supports, and education tools. The platform also holds great potential to lend new data-driven insights into the pursuit of self-sufficiency. And in the process, over the last year and a half of developing this tool and my master's thesis, one of the barriers I've identified in the process of developing a pilot project for something like this is the disparate nature of the data systems and the forms used by various state agencies that serve as the gatekeeper to these resources, from everything from tax credits to TANF. And in order to create a single electronic access point, we need a secure, transferable data form and congruent systems to handle that securely. The recent computer systems security audit conducted by the Secretary of State's office revealed much room for improvement across all 13 of Oregon's agencies that were audited. In the audit, the report says more than half had weaknesses in their data protection, and weaknesses in 6 of the 7 areas reviewed. Most agency security planning documents were inadequate because they were not based on an IT risk assessment designed to identify the unique security needs and risks of each agency. In addition, 2 agencies did not have security plans. The audit recommended that the Office of the State Chief Information Officer collaborate with agencies to develop detailed plans to fully implement the requirements of the executive order that the governor signed pertaining to these matters, and also develop sufficient statewide standards and processing for oversight to ensure security of agency computer systems. I hope that you will support this bill because it's essential to it as a cornerstone to both the future of human services delivery, however we imagine that to be, and to the security of integrated state systems. Oregon agencies have reached a technological juncture, and in this session we have the opportunity to begin the necessary work to protect and share the vital but vulnerable data. And this repetition costs us time and money to the state in the forms of inefficiency but more importantly, it also costs the time and the money of people using state systems and these services. And the time is something that people living under the pressures of poverty don't have the luxury of. And the increased stress of having to go to all these different agencies and supply the same information over and over again isn't helping anyone. And I also come from a background. I worked as a support worker for adults with autism. I've used these state systems, and I've handled the finances of people trying to use these state systems, and this is something that we desperately need. I recognize that most of the senators on the committee today are from urban areas, but the divide between urban and rural is especially important when we're talking about access to state services, and this is something that will most certainly help everyone, but these rural communities will have better access, and that's very important. And I'm happy to take any questions, and once again, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Senator Olson.
Thank you very much, and I want to play a little bit of devil's advocate here. If we get to a uniform system where everybody is working on the same computer platform, how do we, prevent a hacking incident which could open the entire state up to divulging their information, or two, some employee someplace that has access to the system looking up information that is pertinent to someone they dislike or someone they want to get back at? How do you prevent that kind of thing to happen?
Well, I'm not a programming expert. I can't answer that question directly. A lot of that question is answered in the state audit and of the security systems. It goes into very detailed report, and even some of the information in the report was confidential because some of the data vulnerabilities were so great. And so I can't exactly answer that question, but what I can say is that the disparate nature of the systems provides more opportunities for hackers, and by consolidating and securing these forms and this information, we're actually protecting data better. And as I said, there's lots of improvement in that respect, but also, it's important for us to recognize that we do have data breaches. And last year, we had a breach of the IRS, for example, in Oregon. And we are constantly dealing with that threat. And one of the simplest ways to start combating that phenomenon is this bill, is the creation of a secure, integrated form.
Follow up. Is there any way for an individual to say, I don't want my information in that program?
I don't see why that couldn't be built in. But once again, we're talking about the future, and right now we're really working to convene a group to just talk about these exact issues and what it would take. And like I said, I'm not a security expert. I'm a policy person.
Right.
But if you look closely at that state audit of the security of our computer systems, it's very clear where we have room for improvement in those specific areas.
And can I just clarify, your testimony was more about places we could go in the future, but this bill is really about a work group to talk about developing a form that is not electronic. Is that correct? It doesn't create a data system?
No, absolutely not. But it does provide the groundwork to start building those systems. And once we have the agencies on the level where they're able to share data in a secure and efficient way, then we can start thinking about the future. This really is the first step.
Madam Chair,
follow up.
I would just ask anybody in the audience that's going to be on this work group that you consider the fact that there could be an unscrupulous employee that wants to dig in and maybe pick up information on me for the next election campaign. So my point is that we need to, that question has to be broached and looked at. And it's not sincerely for me, but it's for anyone that wants to make certain that their information isn't used in a way that you don't intend it to be used.
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, I think those are absolutely, I think, critical considerations. And I know that at the Department of Justice, we are very concerned about the security of our systems, and that's just something that's at the forefront of our minds. I think that as you say, it's just an increasing risk in the world today as our information becomes more put into electronic form and as our electronic systems become more and more integrated. And I think that's something that we certainly, and I'm certain the Chief Information Officer are going to be very, very attentive to as these programs move forward. As Chair Gelser, as you observed, this particular initiative doesn't involve that sort of electronic data sharing. Is intended to enhance the ability to share data through sort of legal refinements and process refinements. But certainly down the road, that's going to be a greater and greater consideration. And these proposals will help to lay the groundwork for that kind of data sharing.
So, and just to be clear again, so that we're clear, if we move this to the floor and to other conversation, I think there are a lot of issues around electronic security and data security and privacy that Senator Olson has raised. I know Senator Dimbro and Senator Knope and I have sat on education committees where ideas of student data systems, which can provide us important information, have raised a lot of other issues and have become politically very, very difficult as you get into issues of security and privacy. When you said this was the first step, I just want to clarify, the only thing that this bill does is create a group to have a conversation about a form, and it does not commit anybody to any ideas about an electronic database. Am I understanding that correctly?
Clearly, yes, absolutely.
And that would take further legislation, and while it may be a first step, it's not part of a bigger plan. This is not part of a planned agenda to create a statewide database that tracks people from birth until death.
No, absolutely not. I'm simply here to talk about how these relate to my work with my master's thesis, which is about the future, but without the ability to confidentially share information among agencies, there's there's no point in pursuing an integrated system in the future. So if we have this groundwork where we can look at the legal issues and look at what we're trying to accomplish with our confidential sharing, that really is the cornerstone to any sort of integration in the future. And my recommendations and my ideas with my master's thesis have nothing to do with the future of this bill at all, and I want to make that very clear. But we are looking at this as a step in the right direction. And when I say we, I mean me and my work. And I would like to just lend an idea of what this could lead to in the future as far as a comprehensive way for agencies to interact and help people.
Got it. And I'm just clarifying to help the bill move along.
I appreciate it. I don't want to overwhelm anyone.
Yes,
ma'am, you might not know this, but the vested powers in the chair, she can actually give you your master's thesis right now and give you your degree. You did a real good job.
I would be very thankful for that. Saved me a lot of money. But I appreciate you entertaining the idea and clarifying. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further questions for this panel? Seeing none, is there anybody else that would like to be heard on this bill or anybody that... Yes, come on up. And anybody else? Going on? All right, you get the last word.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for not signing up previously. My name is Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager, and I did submit written testimony. Mr. Dumit, I'm sorry, I think I emailed it directly to you rather than using your exhibits email. But the reason I'm taking an interest in this bill is that Lane County several years ago has been working quite a bit on funding and making sure that our sobering center locally could function. And one of the things that we found in that work was it was difficult for the public safety agencies to talk with the treatment providers because of the privacy issues and federal laws that overlay those procedures. So we actually took a resolution, what's called a resolution proposal, to the National Association of Counties to try to align, to seek that association would work within their bailiwick of working with Congress to align HIPAA with the 42 CFR regulations. And that bore some fruit. They have been working on it. And I did want to also let the committee know, with the 21st Century Cures Act passage, which happened in the lame duck of Congress, there's a couple sections that speak to these privacy laws and direct that 42 CFR rules do get finalized within a year, and that the Secretary direct better information out to the states regarding how to better work within the privacy laws. And I just think that if you are moving this bill forward, you've got a great opportunity for this work group to be receiving of that national information and really having the most modern and up-to-date sort of procedures that could be available. So the timing is great.
Thanks so much, Alex. Yeah. Any questions for Alex? Seeing none, thank you very much. And with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 397 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 17.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 17 removes the requirement that superintendents of state hospitals and certain Department of Corrections institutions designate chief medical officers of the institution. It also declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Welcome. We have Joseph Defoe. And even though I introduced you, you still need to introduce yourself for the record, because we like to do things over and over again here.
Charles Gelsler, committee members. My name is Joe Defoe. I'm the Health Service Administrator for the Department of Corrections. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 17 and answer any questions. So, Senate Bill 17 amends statute to remove the superintendent's authority and duty to designate a chief medical officer for their respected institutions. Current status or current statute, ORS 179-360-1F, authorizes the superintendent of each institution to appoint a chief medical officer for that institution, who is directly responsible to the superintendent for the administration of medical treatment programs and assume such other responsibilities as assigned by the superintendent. This statute was created at a time when we had one or two institutions, and we had no centralized administrative services and no centralized medical director. Current state today, we have 13 institutions plus the Forest Camp. We have a centralized service, administrative service, and an appointed centralized medical director. To answer why this would be an emergency clause, that current ORS up against the current OAR, which is 291-124-0016, number 2, empowers our centralized chief medical director to appoint the institutional medical officer. So, chief medical officer. This discrepancy in these two, in the ORS and the OAR, resulted in a recent court appeal decision that invalidated the OAR that allows the centralized medical director to appoint institutional. That is why we utilized the emergency clause, because we would not currently be in compliance with the statute.
And you had to pay out some money as a result of that? Is that?
Well, it was brought on by an adult in custody, and I don't know the specific amount, if any, on this particular case, but typically when they win a judgment, they do receive some form of monetary compensation, but I can't tell you how much that was. If passed, this legislation would allow the centralized chief medical director to designate a licensed physician to serve as the chief medical officer for the institution, which will bring statute in line with DOC's current practices rule and health services policy by repealing Section 1F of the ORS 179-360 in its entirety. For the reason explained above, the department asked this committee to vote Senate Bill 17 out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thanks so much. Any questions for Joe? Are people okay with scheduling this for Monday for a work session?
That, sure.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on this bill? Nope. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 17. And I'm going to shift the agenda because we have far fewer people signed up for Senate Bill 234 than Senate Bill 48. Is there anyone on 48 that has time constraints?
I do have to leave at 2.
You do have to leave at 2? All right, never mind then. So we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 48.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 48 directs certain professional regulatory boards to adopt rules requiring professionals to complete continuing education requirements related to suicide prevention. It directs Oregon Health Authority to oversee the development of continuing education opportunities by the relevant boards and submit a biennial report to the Legislative Assembly documenting the completion of training. It becomes operative on January 1st, 2018. It also declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. And look, right here on the sheet, it says I have to leave at 2 o'clock. So that was well done. My apologies. So first I would invite up Ann Kirkwood, Carol Richards, and Stephanie Willard. And we're going to let Carol go first, is that okay?
Sure. Thank you for your consideration.
You're welcome.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair, and other senators of the committee. Hello, I'm Carol Richards of Salem. Here as a private citizen today, but also a member of the Family Leaders. It's a group of mostly professional, and I'm retired but not tired, so I call myself retreading, creating a new pattern after a long career in human services. I want to speak when I can to the good of our community. So I'm here today to tell you about my friend Susan, who at the age of 35 reawoke to her life's purpose to become a doctor and fought her way into medical school at the overripe age of 36, that's old for medicine, got into the Albert Einstein School of Medicine in New York City, completed that program, internships, residencies, ending up at San Francisco General Hospital in the Family and Community Health Program. Dr. Susan Barnes achieved her goal, her life dream, accumulating more than $300,000 of student loan debt along the way. And her mission to serve communities and families, particularly rural families, didn't look promising to have a lucrative practice to repay those loans. She enrolled herself, discovered a program encouraging physicians to serve our most rural Americans with up to 50% loan forgiveness after years of service and accumulated benefit. She pursued that aspect of her dream became a medical director of a rural community of maybe 25,000 people in the right season, and discovered at this pinnacle of success that her employer's health insurance provided to her was not going to provide health coverage for her only health concern as a pre-existing condition. Do you all remember those? She found herself hundreds of miles from needed but unaffordable health care on the mission that she had worked so hard a decade really to achieve. At age 46, after less than 1 year of service in that community, she was found dead by suicide, having left her dogs with the neighbor who loved them and watched for them when she worked long hours. And I'm here to say her name, Dr. Susan Barnes, and share her experience, because we know life circumstances can overcome the strongest, most passionate, most deserving and devoted and passionate among us, like Susan. So I say to physicians and other titles covered in this bill, above all others, healers are lifeline. We need to check in every 6 years or so for a couple of hours on this topic of suicide. We don't know everything yet, we're learning. Every few years in continuing education, I enjoyed learning and sharing what I had learned in a professional forum on a number of topics. Suicide was not one of them. I speak today as an individual who never dedicated herself or worked directly in suicide. But like many people in the room, we've been touched by a suicide. We've known someone, and they deserve their stories and their names to be remembered. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And because I know that you have to leave, are there questions right now? Thank you for coming and telling what is a really devastating story. And I think it's so important, as you said, to say the names of people and honor those memories and see how we can move on and make things better moving forward and honor those people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ann.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Ann Kirkwood. I'm the Suicide Intervention Coordinator for the Health Systems Division at the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 48. Senate Bill 48 requires licensing boards to adopt rules for certain physical and behavioral health providers and school personnel requiring continuing education in suicide risk assessment, management, and treatment. In 2015, 762 Oregon residents died by suicide. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for Oregonians between the ages of 10 and 34. Over 2,000 of our residents are hospitalized for suicidal behavior every single year. In 2015, tragically, 16% of 11th graders reported that they had seriously considered suicide in the previous 12 months. This is alarming. Despite our best efforts on behalf of these young people, the suicide rate among youth has been rising every year since 2011. Unfortunately, the very people that we asked with intervening and treating people contemplating suicide have little or no training in suicide risk assessment, management, and treatment. Senate Bill 48 aims to provide professionals who work with youth at risk and at-risk adults the skills they need to feel competent and confident to identify suicide risk and provide the needed treatment. A trained professional can intervene and can save a life. If the public expects Oregon professionals to responsibly care for suicidal adults and children, we need to give them the training and support to do that. Providing continuing education will fill the gap between patients' needs and providers' knowledge and ensure that our state's professionals have the competence and confidence to save lives. A study published in the Journal of Suicide and Life-Threatening Behavior reported that among mental health providers, only 25% of social workers received training in suicide management and treatment during their college education. Only 6% of marriage and family therapists receive that training. And incredibly, only 2% of accredited counselor education programs offer this training. A lack of college-level education in suicide treatment and management leaves a significant gap that continuing education can fill. This bill is modeled after legislation passed in Washington State in 2012 called the Matt Adler Suicide Assessment, Treatment, and Management Act. And I should say, incidentally, Washington has a lower suicide rate than Oregon. That law has been updated over the years, most recently in 2015. Washington advocates report that some providers initially opposed the legislation but have changed their minds since completing the mandatory training. Written testimony to this committee comes from Paul Quinnett, a Washington State psychologist who was involved in passage of their legislation and is one of the individuals who is training medical and behavioral health providers in Washington State. I just call your attention to one section of his written testimony. Quote, "As you know by now, pushback from membership organization lobbyists is strong, as no provider wants to be told by the government how to practice, what to study, and what continuing education they should take. However, as the past chair of the Board of Examiners in Psychology for the state of Washington, it is the public's health that matters, not the elective continuing education choices preferred by licensed healthcare professionals," unquote. So in discussing with me how training is going in Washington, Dr. Quinnett said, and I quote again, "Just this morning I spoke with a physician who took the mandatory training, and he said that he did not like to be told what he should do with his continuing education requirements. But after the training, he said he could plainly see why it was needed, both in his practice and in his family." Looking at the bill, in Section 1, Subsection 3, Senate Bill 48 says that the training requirement for behavioral health providers, including school counselors, is at least 3 and no more than 6 hours once every 6 years. In Section 4, the training requirement for physical health providers is at least 6 hours, one time only during their career. Section 1, Subsection 5 also provides that the licensing boards can exempt individual professionals from the requirement if they already have the knowledge and skills that would be in that training. Such an exemption also could be possible for professionals who do not work directly with patients, for example, medical examiners. Section 6 authorizes boards to determine if these hours are to be in addition to other continuing education requirements or instead of any existing requirements. So in short, the bill does not need to add to the current number of hours a professional receives. So these sections were added based on a review of the legislative history in Washington and the concerns that were raised by these professional groups so that we were accommodating in what we wrote for Oregon. Best practice training in suicide intervention, assessment, and management is widely available at no cost or low cost in the state of Oregon. Web-based and community-based trainings also are available at no or low cost. While the bill is modeled after the Washington state law, other states have adopted similar legislation, including Nevada, Utah, Kentucky, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Montana, Illinois, and Louisiana. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention advocates for such mandatory continuing education laws in all 50 states. Their report on training notes that, quote, "a crucial step toward reducing the rate of suicide among people in the U.S., unquote, is training. Training for physical and behavioral health providers and school personnel is encouraged by the U.S. Surgeon General, the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention, the National Strategy for Suicide Prevention, the American Association for Suicidology, and I would say most importantly, it's an objective written into the Oregon Youth Suicide Prevention Plan, which was created by 100 stakeholders and released in 2016. The new statewide Oregon Alliance to Prevent Suicide is made up of 65 experts in suicide prevention and stakeholders who work with at-risk individuals. And it's closely monitoring the bill, and several members are here to testify today or have submitted written testimony. One member, Dr. Christy Nix, a family physician from Bend, has submitted written testimony for the record. Dr. Nix says she did not receive suicide risk assessment, management, and treatment instruction in medical school. She had to seek out that training to improve care in her practice and did so when her brother died by suicide. Another member, Dr. Kirk Wolf, has submitted written testimony from the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, reporting that their executive committee voted last night to support Senate Bill 48. Training has proven effective in preparing professionals to address a suicide crisis. A study in 13 states of 1,100 professionals who took a 7-hour training on risk assessment, management, and treatment showed that only 9 to 35% passed the 25-item pretest. After the class, the pass rate increased dramatically to 95 to 100%. So we do see learning improvements. Multiple studies also have shown that up to 75% of those who complete suicide had seen a primary care provider in the previous year. Nationally, there's been an increase in negligence-based lawsuits against school systems alleging failure to respond to student suicide risk. The implementation of a systematic training could reduce the liability that our schools face when teachers and counselors are unprepared to deal with youth in crisis. According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, 90% of Americans who die by suicide have a treatable mental illness, substance use disorder, or both. These people are ill-served when they are referred to professionals who are unprepared to address suicide risk. In addition, best practice interventions by trained providers in our emergency rooms and health systems can reduce the risk of expensive return visits for subsequent suicide crises. The Henry Ford Health System in Michigan started a suicide initiative and across a decade reduced its suicide rate among patients by 80%. In 2009 alone, the number of suicides was zero. Their initiative mandated training. Every suicide is preventable if we know the warning signs and respond effectively. Senate Bill 48 is a first step toward making suicide prevention in Oregon a serious priority. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm glad to answer questions.
Thank you. And let's let Stephanie speak, and then we'll do questions for the panel. Is that helpful? Thank you.
I want to thank
you. Might pull the microphone just a little closer to you before you introduce yourself for the record.
Is that better?
Yes.
I want to thank Chair Gelser and Vice Chair Olson, members of the Senate Human Services Committee today for their time. I come to you wearing two hats. The first is I'm a licensed acupuncturist and I've been practicing for 18 years. The licensed acupuncturists are not included in the scope of Senate Bill 48. I want to say how vitally important it is to mandate trainings in certain areas. Every practitioner has a required amount of continuing education units, CEUs, to renew their licenses. For an acupuncturist, it's broken down into both oriental medicine classes as well as allopathic medicine. In the state of Oregon, there was a statute in 2015, ORS 413.590, where we as acupuncturists were mandated to include pain management, CEUs, as a result of the opioid epidemic. This is very similar to the law being presented to you today with requiring mandatory continuing education in a specific area. As with any new law or mandate in your field, there was a scramble to understand what it meant, the implications, and the timelines to make that happen. It's not that I would not seek out continuing education and pain management related, but having it required to renew my license gave me the push to make that education happen. If I did not, I could not renew my license, and therefore I could not practice. It's really that simple. So, of course, that education happened. Suicide rates have been increasing and is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. There are an average of 121 people per day that die by suicide, and these numbers have been increasing year after year. Which leads me to my second and more important hat. On May 8th, 2014, my husband's, Jesse's, brain broke. He shot and killed our four-year-old daughter and then himself, and I found them a couple hours later. He was my best friend, a devoted husband, brother, son, and an amazing father of our two girls. He fiercely loved his family. Maribella was my sunshine. Her laughter was contagious, her compassion humbling, and she was so very smart. Her eyes sparkled as she came up with ways to entertain people. She was just like her father in her athletic abilities. At 4 years old, she had goals already. She wanted to learn to read and ride her bike without training wheels by the time she was five. Her life got cut short of those goals by 44 days. The ripple effects of their murder-suicide are just as fresh today, almost 3 years later, as they were that rainy day in May. Suicide is preventable. People will often see their primary care practitioner, a variety of other health care professionals, or behavioral health specialists within the year they die by suicide. My husband saw a psychiatrist that morning. Those of us in the healthcare field have an opportunity and responsibility every day with our patients to ask basic questions that would screen for suicidal ideology. The training and treatment protocols are constantly changing and improving, as with the Henry Ford system, as Ann just said. As with any disease, it is vital to stay up to date on ways to screen and support vulnerable people who are considering suicide as an option. There are many free online trainings available that are best practices and up to date in the field of suicide risk assessment, treatment, and management. With this law, it will require this training. With this law, lives will be saved because of it. With this law, someone may not have to experience the pain I do every single day for the past almost 3 years. We need to do a better job with our screening and support, and this is absolutely one way to make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and I'm terribly sorry for your loss is a word that's too small, and I'm grateful to you for being willing to come forward and talk about such an intimate issue. Are there questions for this panel? Yes, she did. No? Thank you very much. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Next up, we have Jerry Gabe, Julie Majors, and Ryan Price. Welcome, and you can start in whichever order you like.
We didn't plan. So
okay, I'll go. I'll jump in. Hi. Thank you for allowing us to testify here and for the committee for giving us this time. My name is Ryan Price, and I'm here on behalf of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention in support of Senate Bill 48. One of the effective strategies we utilize to save lives from suicide is advocating for public policies that will save lives, and so that's what I'm doing here. Suicide is preventable, and Senate Bill 48 is one policy that will help prevent the tragic loss of suicide in Oregon. You may already be aware that suicide is a leading cause of death in Oregon, and that many people who die by suicide are seen by a medical professional shortly before they take their own lives. The vast majority of medical professionals, including even mental health professionals, don't receive routine training in suicide assessment, treatment, or risk. And without proper training and awareness on suicide-specific skills, health professionals may miss the warning signs and risk factors in their patients and in patients under their care who are at a high risk of dying by suicide. So as you consider this bill and hear the remainder of the testimony, I want to encourage you to consider three things and then one oversimplified scenario. So the first thing, number one, is that suicide is complex, but it is preventable. And number two, there are warning signs that indicate a person might be at risk of suicide. And number three, people at risk might be good at hiding their suicidal ideation from those closest to them. So here's an oversimplified scenario. Imagine your loved one is dealing with a bout of undiagnosed clinical depression when they're rear-ended on their drive home from work. They're mostly okay, but their shoulder was hurt so bad they could no longer perform the job. They were and they were ultimately let go, which leads to a difficult financial season for them and their family. This loved one starts thinking that, you know, maybe they're going to be better off without me, because he feels like a burden, or she feels like a burden to them, and they've not sought treatment for their mental illness. One day, during an ongoing treatment at a physical therapist or chiropractor or a visit to their primary care or naturopathic doctor, they say something like, you know, things have been really tough for me, and some days I wish I could just go to sleep and not wake up. Sure hope my shoulder gets fixed. It's kind of a conversation you might hear at a doctor's office. Would that medical professional take that loved one's comment seriously? And if they did, would they know what to do? This is a very, very serious statement made by the person in this scenario. And the only time the person may have verbalized that they were actually thinking about suicide. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify. And I've also submitted written testimony for the record, which includes some more details and statistics. But I am assuming you'll have questions afterwards. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Great. So good afternoon.
Can you pull the microphone
over before you introduce yourself?
Is this better?
Much better.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Olson stepped out. Members of the committee, thank you for hearing us today on this important topic. My name is Julie Majors. I represent the voice of a parent with a child who has a history of being hospitalized for suicide attempts. As a family support specialist, walking beside other families who have children who frequently experience suicidal ideation and attempts and crises. And I'm also a member of the Youth Suicide Intervention and Prevention Plan Alliance, and I feel very honored to be a part of that incredible group of people who really know a lot about this topic. I want to tell you just one brief story about a time my daughter turned to a walk-in crisis center. She told the worker her history of suicide attempts, her present state of mind, and the circumstances that brought her to the walk-in center, and in fact told them that she was so desperate she was starting to make lists of what she should do before she died. And she was 19 at that time. The worker did help her, presented her some options, which in my opinion fell short of what she was really presenting as her risk. They had her friend bring her alone over to the emergency department, where she waited for 4 hours unattended to get help. By that time, my daughter had spent 3 years with a history of developing skills to recognize her own risk and to learn how to advocate for the care that she needed. And I'm so pleased to say that she actually did exercise those great skills and advocacy, and she got the help she needed. She spent 3 days inpatient and left with a better plan and being shored up. The worker that had seen her at the crisis center called her therapist and said to the therapist, I'm just really surprised on whether or not she really is suicidal or would act on it, because she's able to articulate herself so well and she has such an incredible self-awareness and insight. The therapist responded with, please don't let that fool you. Those great strengths are, like you were just speaking, those that cover up people seeing really where she is at risk and vulnerable. I share this story because my experience is seeing personal biases among healthcare workers on the topic of suicide getting in the way of best and safe practices for our loved ones. I believe that training and practice renders us more competent in any field that we're pursuing. When preconceived ideas and biases of what suicidal looks like, feels like, sounds like, gets in the way, discomforts on the topic of suicide, which we often see among healthcare workers and education professionals,
it gets in the way of known best practices on recognizing and treating and making the appropriate referrals. We leave people and their families with less and sometimes more care than is actually appropriate to the what's being presented. Today, my daughter is doing quite well, and I have to say that it's in large part to the training that her therapist and my therapist have had in bringing us along, and then the training that we and knowledge now that we possess. Training and practice not only builds skills and knowledge, it also helps us check our biases and our discomforts. I realize mandatory training asks more of our hardworking healthcare and crisis workers, but without a mandate, it just really doesn't seem to be happening. That's not what we're experiencing with a lot of the families whose children are seeking care. This bill is only requiring 3 to 6 hours per 6 years. I, as a paraprofessional peer support worker, have many more hours than that is requiring of the healthcare workers that our folks with suicidal ideation and attempts are turning to for help. Senators, if 2 plane crashes per month resulted in the deaths of all the passengers, and it was believed that more skilled pilots could make a difference in preventing those, I think we would all support mandatory training without a question. Having our healthcare workers adequately trained on how to detect and respond to our loved ones at risk of dying by suicide is a basic expectation that families hold, and I urge a yes vote on moving this bill forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and Jerry.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, Senator Dembo, who happens to represent my district, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Gabay. I'm a retired attorney and nonprofit executive. Formerly, I was executive director of La Familia Sana, a Hispanic health promotion agency in Oregon and Washington. Currently, I'm on the board of NAMI Oregon and am a member of the Oregon Alliance to Prevent Youth Suicide. However, I am testifying on my own behalf today. Many of you may remember me from 2015. When I drafted the initial concepts for HB 2948 and 2023, both of which later became law. As you may remember my story, I'll be brief, or at least briefer than normal. My daughter Susanna was 21 when she had a psychotic breakdown while a student at Clark Honors College at the U of O. She was held at Sacred Heart Hospital, first on a 48-hour police hold, then admitted to the secure psychiatric unit for 8 days. The first day she was on suicide watch, but the hospital did not tell us that. They told us almost nothing. The psychiatrist said blithely that she had had a psychiatric episode. She might have others, or she might not. May never have another. That was it. You passed the Susanna Blake Gabay Act in 2015 to help address such failures of communication, and for that her mother and I are deeply grateful. It is our belief that the head psychiatrist was not adequately trained to assess and analyze suicide risk, nor adequately trained on how to prevent suicide. I expect you, like us, have no idea how that could have been the case. But I have read in professional journals and have been told directly by psychiatric colleagues that many mental health professionals are neither adequately trained nor comfortable in dealing with suicide or suicide threat. There were earlier experiences that even more strongly demonstrated lack of preparation. When Susanna was a junior in high school, she was at the home of a friend who called to say that she was catatonic. We immediately drove to that house, and truly she was catatonic. We had to carry her to the car in order to transport her to the emergency department. The hospital staff approached the situation totally from the perspective of a drug reaction. They tested her thoroughly and found no drugs whatsoever in her system. She was not a drug user. She had been receiving meds for depression for over a year, and a poorly trained primary care physician had just changed her prescription, doubling the dosage irresponsibly in too short a time. But, and this is my point, the emergency department did not treat her as a potential suicide risk, nor did they assess her for mental illness. Susanna visited the ED in Eugene at least once while attending college there. They released her at 5 in the morning to walk back to her dorm in order to go on a field trip that Saturday morning. She had gotten there late Friday night or early Saturday morning. She had been judged at risk for self-harm way back in her senior year in high school, yet poorly trained providers somehow did not link these events, nor, as I earlier suggested, were they comfortable in addressing them. This bill, I believe, will go far to address these sorts of shortcomings and may well save lives. In fact, I cannot imagine that it will not save lives. You may hear opposition from professional groups who oppose all mandates. 3 to 6 hours of training appears to me to be a small price to pay in order to reduce the death rate by suicide in Oregon, which at 17.4 per 100,000 far exceeds the CDC definition of an epidemic. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Are there any brief questions for this panel? And thank you all
thank you very much.
Thank you. And next up we have Jen Baker, Courtney Dresser, and Eva Ribeteau.
Welcome.
Thanks.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Jen Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon, here to express concerns with this legislation. While we, both ONA and NPO, believe that suicide prevention and education is incredibly important, and certainly sympathize with all that we've heard here today, to make it a requirement of licensure is not something that our organizations can support. Currently, nurses in the state of Oregon only have one continuing education requirement, and it's upon the first renewal of licensure. It's the pain management CE that you've already heard about today. Rather than having continuing education requirements for nurses here in Oregon, we have a practice hour requirement. And part of the rationale behind this is because the nursing workforce is so broad that to ask each nurse to complete continuing education in specific issue areas is not always the best use of their time and resources and doesn't further professional development. Rather, most nurses get certification in their specialty area. So an ER nurse would get emergency room training, a NICU nurse, so on and so forth, so that they can make sure that their time and resources invested in their continuing education actually further professional development. And while 3 to 6 hours of suicide prevention education certainly seems like not a lot to ask, and ONA and NPO would be happy to work with the advocates to develop curriculum and help promote it for our membership, I do think it's important to look at the full picture of all of these really compelling issues that come up each session, usually 3 to 5 continuing education bills that have, you know, the same ask of 3 to 6 hours upon renewal, and all of that really does add up, and it makes it unmanageable for providers to maintain. I'll also assure you that nurses in their curriculum have extensive suicide prevention training, and I can get the specifics to you. I know it starts in the second year with an introductory course in the first semester, and then a more in-depth course the second semester. And ONA is proud through our continuing education program to also offer suicide prevention options for folks who work in these areas and want to seek that continuing education.
Thank you very much.
Courtney.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. This is a very powerful and emotional issue. We've heard some very emotional testimony, and I'm sure we all have been affected or know someone who's been affected by suicide, because I know that my family and I have been, for sure. The OMA is very supportive of the goal of Senate Bill 48, which is to reduce suicide rates in our state and hopefully have that down to zero. However, we cannot support the language as it is the mandate of CME. I think my colleague from ONA just spoke very well about the numerous bills that come forward through the legislative process to mandate training on providers, and it does become a little bit cumbersome and how those providers would be able to do all of those things and take the required training they need to continue to practice the practice that they have. So with that in mind, though, OMA has been working a great deal around mental health, behavioral health, including suicide prevention. For example, we have mental health practice, expanding mental health practice, including behavioral health practice, as one of our strategic plans at the OMA. It is part of our list of things we're working on. We're a part of an active participant in a legislative work group that is working on some bills for this session. We also were part of implementing and worked on a toolkit for our providers to implement the bill that was just discussed, House Bill 2948. I think that's the right number. We're very proud of the OMA members who took leadership roles in creating and finally getting the Unity Center up and open in Portland. And we are also very concerned with this, as you heard earlier, on a personal or professional level for our community, as we are seeing a rise in suicide among physicians and medical students nationwide and here in our state. Our entire annual conference in the fall will be based on the joy of bringing back the joy of the practice of medicine to our providers, and self-care will be part of that curriculum. We also have the ability now at the OMA to accredit it our own and create our own CME, and we are creating CME on mental health awareness and suicide prevention for our members and physicians statewide. So we're doing a lot of these efforts, and we hope that we'll be allowed to do that and not in a required, mandated, forceful way.
Thank you so much. Eva.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. Eva Ripito with Oregon AFSCME Council 75. I don't have details such as my colleagues have, but AFSCME also shares the concerns that OMA and ONA have. We represent doctors and nurses around the state and other behavioral health professionals. And you know, certainly acknowledge that suicide is a persistent public health crisis, and we want to be helpful in crafting language that works to meet the goals. And share the concerns about the condition of licensing when there are so many varied licensing requirements depending on the specialty. Thank you.
Thank you. Is this one unique? I know in a number of the other requirements, they're recurring, that you have to do this one recurring. And I don't think I understood until Ann's testimony today that this wouldn't be upon the renewal of the license. It would just be one time. Is that unique for this, and does that make a difference?
I think it depends on what you're licensed as, according to the bill. I think for some it'd be one time, and for others it would be over a recurring thing.
But in terms of the question, if it was one time, does that make a difference to you? Is it all together, or is it the frequency? Is frequency a place where if that was adjusted, you might be able to get to a place of more comfort?
I think even when you do a one time, as for physicians, they have a required amount that they have to take to be board certified. That usually means if we're going to require something else, even one time, it means during that cycle something goes away and they fill it up with this. I think the other piece is just the mandating piece. We didn't have a very good history with the pain management mandate, and I think we've learned that that's not the best way for providers to learn, and so we want to find a way to incorporate this information either in things that we're already doing or encourage it through making up one that is relevant to their practice.
Thank you.
Senator Dimbo. Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. Maybe this is a good time for me to articulate this concern. I appreciate the proponents limiting the requirement to 3 to 6 hours, and this may be paradoxical because I'm an educator, but I kind of question the value of a three-hour, especially an internet kind of course on a subject like this. There'll be a pretest and a post-test, and You know, you spend some time reading something online. But I just, you know, I really question whether or not this, the extent to which this really will change behavior. And, you know, in my own experience, you know, I think there's more gain that derives when you have a kind of institutional commitment, you know, let's say a hospital-wide or a, you know, agency-wide commitment to a sort of ongoing, repeated way of drawing attention to something. And, you know, I'm a little worried that, you know, if we say, okay, we've mandated, a three-hour, one-time course, we've dealt with the problem. So what would really be useful for me would be to maybe see some examples of some of these courses that are out there. Recognizing that, some are going to be better than others, but some are also going to be much more expensive than others or require travel, which becomes a challenge for rural providers. But just to kind of get a sense of you know, will this really change behavior, which is something we absolutely, just speaking for myself, want to see happen.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 48. Thank you also very much. It was a lot of very compelling testimony, and I'm sure we'll continue discussing this back in this committee again. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 48 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 239.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 239 establishes a process to determine consent of residents of residential care facilities or adult foster homes to individually based limitations of certain rights upon a finding that the resident is incapable of providing or withholding consent. It also defines terms.
Thank you very much. And we are a little bit short on time. And one of the things that I want to clearly get on the record, I know some work has been done between the advocates of the bill and Oregon Right to Life to clarify the intent and the scope. So I'm wondering if we could start with Bob Junduff and Colm Willis, just so that, because I know some of us have received letters, and it would be good, Bob, if you could come up, tell us what the intent is, and if both of you could describe where we are in terms of moving forward.
Chair Gelzer and members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Senate Bill 239 comes to you because of a federal regulation requirement. To state it as briefly as possible, the federal government has created new regulations that recognize that people who live in Medicaid-funded residential settings have certain rights, and that if those rights are to be limited, they need to consent to the limitation of those rights. We've formed a work group in order to come up with the framework for how a process can be established in law to obtain substitute decision-making when a person who's in residential care is incapable of making decisions for themselves. And our work group has been working for months now. We are not done by any, unfortunately, and more work is being done. Colm has brought to us a concern about how some of the wording in the bill looks right now. We completely agree with those concerns. In that we do not want the wording of the bill to be misconstrued in any way in terms of having the reverse effect of hurting an individual who's in care. This is all designed to make sure that people in care are safe and that their rights are honored. And that as many people as possible are involved in the process to assure that there's many eyes on, so that if a person needs to have some type of a right limited, that it doesn't happen in the dark. And so we've sat down today and talked about it. We're working towards some language that can suit all of our needs. That language should come to you in a group of amendments that still need to be added to the bill to bring it up to all of the various requirements of federal law.
Thank you. And Colm.
So what Bob said is
could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Colm Willis, and I'm here at the request of Oregon Right to Life. to share some concerns about Senate Bill 239. What Bob said is correct. We have been in discussions. With your permission, I'd like to kind of articulate our concerns for the record and as a way to kind of talk about where we hope we're going. As currently written, Senate Bill 239 would allow a residential care facility or an adult foster home to obtain consent to limit a resident's right to access food freely and with support at any time. As Bob mentioned, that idea comes from federal regulations that were recently enacted, but the language is different than the federal language, and that causes us some concern. This consent may be obtained from a descending list of surrogate decision makers, which ultimately includes a committee of people not related to or appointed by the resident. So we believe the language is vague and is insufficient to protect vulnerable residents from potential abuse as currently written. And additionally, because the bill would protect surrogate decision makers and a facility from facing any civil, criminal, or professional liabilities for obtaining this consent, that's the reason we asked you and Bob to clarify the language, to make it clear that this bill would not allow a facility to obtain consent to starve a resident to death. We've recommended an amendment to the bill that I'd like to read into the record, with also the statement that this has not been agreed to by other stakeholders in the process. So we recommend an amendment that would say, notwithstanding paragraph 1 of section 2, a residential care facility, including but not limited to an assisted living facility, may not obtain a decision regarding consent under this section to limit a resident's right to the usual and typical provision of nutrition and hydration that's necessary to ensure a resident does not suffer a substantial and irreversible physical impairment of a major bodily function. And notwithstanding paragraph 1 of this section, a residential care facility, including but not limited to an assisted living facility, may not obtain a decision regarding consent under this section to limit a resident's right to assistance with eating, such as the provision of nutrition and hydration by cup, hand, bottle, drinking straw, or eating utensil. And we recommended similar language to amend section 4 of the bill, which deals with adult foster homes. We also recommended changing the definition in the bill regarding individually based limitations to more closely follow the language that's in federal law. We respect very much the good work that Bob does and other proponents of this bill. And we've had some very productive conversations on ways to amend it, and I hope very sincerely that we can come to a consensus. But I do want to emphasize that we believe that if the bill is enacted as currently written, it could have very severe unintended consequences that could endanger the lives of vulnerable people in our communities.
And then again, just to clarify, it seems that nobody is advocating to pass the bill as it's currently written. This ongoing conversation is
Chair Gelser, that's
moving
correct.
On to address the concerns.
Yeah. Super. Right.
Great. And I just really want to thank you, Colm, and Oregon Right to Life for coming forward ahead of time before we got to the hearing so that you all could connect before there was a lot of chaos and that sometimes makes it a little bit difficult to untangle. I don't know that your intentions were entirely diametrically opposed
Not at all. We're very much on the same page. It's just a matter of getting it technically correct.
All right. Are there other questions for this panel? Nope, seeing none. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next, John Mullen and Gwen Dayton.
Chair Gelser, this is Bob Jundiff again.
Hi, Bob
from Disability
Jundiff.
Rights.
Nice to meet you.
thank you. John Mullen had to leave, but
okay.
He wanted me to tell you that Oregon Law Center supports the bill with the recognition of all the things that have been said and is looking forward to participating in rulemaking once we're able to get some legislation done.
All right. I just did have one other question, Comfield. Be free to come back up. In the amendment language that you read, where it gets pretty specific,
yes,
would that allow if there was a? So I have known elderly or non-elderly disabled people where actually there was a limitation from using a straw because it became a choking risk. It became an issue. Would there still be the ability to make those kinds of
I mean, would a person be required to use a straw if using that straw would cause them to gag or choke or?
That's a really good point to raise. I adopted this language from the language we use in ORS Chapter 127, dealing with advanced directives and clarifying the rights of surrogates to make decisions removing fluids and food from folks at the end of life. And there's clarifying language that I adopted in here, since that's what we currently use in Oregon law to clarify what surrogates, what types of assistance surrogates can choose to withhold for protected people. So we may need to look at that and see if there's currently a practical problem with, you know.
And I think as you're all working, I don't know about others, but that's one of the questions that I would have, and also just ensuring that while we're trying to keep this narrowly focused on complying with this federal regulation change, that we are also not in any way going in and changing advanced directives or the rights of people to make their own end-of-life decisions in an advanced directive.
And we completely agree with that.
Thank you.
Just following up on that question, there's not a requirement here that a feeding tube be used in
no.
the situation, right?
No, not at all. In fact, Oregon law very much gives you the right to refuse a feeding tube.
Thank you very much. All right, now Gwen Dayton.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Gwen Dayton. I'm General Counsel for the Oregon Healthcare Association. I'm here because this bill affects all of our community-based care members, and we are the entities that would comply with this. OHCA has been an active participant in the work group that put this together, and we very much appreciate the opportunity to do that. I know you have time constraints. I submitted some written testimony that I'm sure you can review at your convenience. I'll just highlight a few things. This bill is intended to help all of us or ensure all of us can comply with federal law. So it's an important bill that we get right, and we've been working, I've been working actively with Mr. Joondeff and Mr. Willis on the language that you just heard about to try to get that right. And it's a narrow, it's a fine line we're walking with it for all the reasons that you've indicated. We want to make sure that there aren't any unintended consequences with the limitations that could be imposed here. Nobody has that as a goal, but we don't want to affect other laws and other rights. And so we're working very hard to get that language correct, and we look forward to bringing that back to you when we have agreement amongst all of us. We think, though, as a general concept, this bill is well put together. We think that it it allows for a limitation to be placed when somebody's health and safety is at risk, and that's very important to our members. But it also has firewalls and safety boundaries placed so that a resident cannot be subjected to something that they would not otherwise want or that is not in their best interest. So we think the balance is done pretty well. I'm glad to answer any questions that you might have, but understand we'll be likely back before you again.
Thank you very much. And you mentioned this, but you're part of this ongoing conversation.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Fantastic. Questions for, yes.
Thank you. I just got this, and thank you for this handout. But I have, and your first two bullet points, they seem to be diametrically opposed.
Oh, I hope.
Requirement of a finding that a resident is incapable. So
right.
There's a group that finds that he's incapable, but then the resident may appeal a finding of incapacity. So if he's incapable, how can he appeal his incapacity?
Senator Gelser, or Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, yes. First of all, it's important to understand this bill only applies to those who are not capable. So it's a narrow slice of those who would need to consent to an individually based limitation. And it's an important trigger, we think, because we don't want to have somebody else make a decision on behalf of somebody if they're capable of doing it themselves, right? But it's also important, and I don't want to speak for this for others, but my understanding, it's very important to others that this finding of capacity be valid and appropriate so that somebody is not found incapable when, in fact, they might be capable, where nobody, including OHCA, has any interest in violating anybody's autonomy rights here. So it's stated in the bill that there would be a process for an appeal of a finding of incapacity. Your issue is the same one, frankly, that I've raised in the group. Who's going to appeal it because the person themselves has been found incapable? So we need to determine an appropriate process for that to happen. I don't want to go too far with it, but it could involve somebody standing in the shoes of the person or something like that. But it was important to many on the work group that there be some opportunity to at least appeal this initial finding.
So, A or one, it was brought up, which is important. And B or two, Who would, if you have a group of people that determine someone's incapable and the person is allowed to appeal it, who do they appeal to? The same group that just found them incapable?
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, no, I hope not. But that is a process that needs to be developed.
Okay, so the I hope not is it really clears it up for me. We don't know.
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, no, we don't know, but it could not be. The finding of capacity in the bill is done by a healthcare professional, like a physician. NPPA, we're also considering adding an RN. So it's an individual that would make the finding. The appeal would have to go to a different and separate entity for an objective review.
And thank you very much. And you said you were involved in this coordinated work effort?
Yes, Senator.
Would you make certain on my behalf that that's brought up and that I had concerns about where the appeal goes to so that it's all included in there so we're very clear that the person that made the group of people that made the finding will not accept the appeal? And just to be clear about that, because if it's that way, I'm going to strongly oppose it.
Yes, Senator, I certainly will. I appreciate that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And again, it's always great when there is a bill that's complex and complicated. This is just a great example of people really reaching out and doing the work. So thank you very much. Appreciate
Madam
it.
Chair, it's not done yet.
But we want to encourage good
Absolutely.
Work that's in process.
Absolutely.
Right? I'm giving a compliment to Oregon Right to Life.
That's
I'll
right.
Here. All right. With that, we are closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 239, and we are adjourned. Thank you.